Back in October, apparently, they think they've discovered a notebook that contained the earliest translation notes from one of the King James translators. This was in some library somewhere in England, and an American scholar doing some research happened upon it, and it was mislabeled. They thought it was like a kind of like a commentary kind of thing. But as they looked at it more carefully, it became clear it was actually translation notes, they think, by one of the translators working on the King James. So they're excited about it because it really gives, it's the earliest in the process we've been able to get into the mind of the translators and how they were taking their Greek and Hebrew manuscripts together with the Latin that they had and trying to piece that together. So I don't think they've finally verified, you know, however that process works in scholarly land, that that's what it is, but they're quite certain that that's what it is. So anyway, interesting that I think was discovered last year. So, all right, well, let's stop before we jump into Tyndale this morning and pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we come to you this morning thinking of great number of people that are living in places of immense turmoil and death all around and fear all around. And we're pleading with you to take your truth and let it, as we've talked about here, let the word run in some of those places to make disciples of your Son and to glorify you. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Well, I've never really done anything like what I'm doing in this series. I've never really kind of tried to teach some church history like this. And so I feel like I'm a little bit in out of my league and a little bit in uncharted waters here. But I'm convinced this is very valuable and very important. And if I can play one little tiny role in God's big purposes and help to keep alive some really important memories, I want to do that. And one of the things that happens when you study church history is you get a little better feel for your place in God's purposes. You know, the way we look at life, we tend to see our little world and it's huge to us. Our little life, our little problems, our little situations are massive. They are what consume our thinking. And then you zoom back and you see your little speck of a life in God's big purposes and you go, oh, okay, you know, I can just be faithful today. So there is immense value in looking back and learning some of these things. And Tyndale particularly just cries out for our attention. Born around 1494, no later than 1495, killed in 1536. Now, I have been mispronouncing his name. Turns out you pronounce it Tyndale, like spindle, not Tyndale. So I am from now on supposed to say Tyndale, but I have spent my whole life saying Tyndale, so good luck with that. William Tyndale. Thankfully, we don't have to worry about spelling his name right because English was just not standardized enough in the early 1500s for there to be standardized spelling. So there are like seven different spellings of his name, including more than one that he used himself. And beyond that, he actually had two different last names. And we're uncertain of the story of why, but one of his key opponents would use his other last name, Hutchins, to make fun of him when he wanted to. So we don't know the story behind that. But anyways, and apparently there was no drawing or painting, no portrait of Tyndale made during his lifetime, so we don't know what he looked like. And we know basically nothing about the first half of his life. So who cares about William Tyndale? That's our question. And before I get there, let me cite some of my sources, again, emphasizing to you that all of this material has been borrowed from other people. I'm not teaching you anything that I went to England and researched myself. These are far and away the two most valuable resources that I'm using. The second book there, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but I'm just going to say Daniel, by David Daniel, is pretty much the scholarly biography of recent years. It was put out by Yale Press in 1994. The top one there is much more recent, put out in 2012. by one of the Christian publishing houses, and both of them are good. David Daniel is kind of the premier William Tyndale scholar. So those are my primary sources, though. There is this little book by Dr. David Beale, A Pictorial History of Our English Bible, that's very helpful, though much more brief. And then I've also used some other books like From the Mind of God to the Mind of Man and Neil Lightfoot's book on how we got the Bible. There is a website, Tyndale.org, that is just tremendous. It's run by the Tyndale Society. It's kept up to date, and it's got all the best links to all the best information. And then there are some intriguing videos. There is this BBC video that was on YouTube a few weeks ago, and I think maybe is not now. I'm kind of confused. But I watched it, so I think it must have been there. The Most Dangerous Man in Tudor England. It's very fascinating. I'm going to quote some from it today and probably other times in this series. There's an interview that you can get some places online with David Daniel called William Tyndale, Man with a Mission, that's worth watching. The most popular dramatization of his life is the movie that's called God's Outlaw, which I don't know, maybe I saw a long, long time ago. I can't remember. So I don't know whether I can recommend that to you or not. I think so, but I haven't seen it for a long, long time. But if you can find that, The Most Dangerous Man in Tudor England, you would enjoy it. It's well worth watching. And then there are all kinds of other brief, you know, little Christian kids books and stuff on Tyndale that are out there. So, but these are by far the two main sources. All right, and you know, part of the reason why I need to do that is because there's been so much chatter about Christian pastors plagiarizing their material. So that's why you hear me keep coming back week after week and remind you, this material's not mine, because unfortunately those headlines keep coming. Okay, so who cares about William Tyndale? Well, let's begin with a bit of silliness, courtesy of David Teams, and I'm going to show you a paragraph which isn't going to make very much sense at all. Don't worry about that, that's not the point. If you have ever been to the seashore just because the waves somehow enchanted you, or if on a particular visit someone kicked sand in your boyfriend's face, an outdated and inexcusable act, thinking him a weakling, though you refused to believe it because you happened to be wearing rose-colored glasses and because of a long-suffering faith in your dearly beloved, or simply because you consider him a godly man, unbeliever that he used to be, William Tyndale gave you the words to tell your story. If by some act of childishness on the part of one of your friends, a particular busybody, though you once thought them the salt of the earth, you have ever been used as a scapegoat, or if that bad grade you got in English caused an uproar in your home, in spite of how zealous you were about Keats, how much time you spent at your writing table, or how that stiff-necked teacher, that taskmaster Mr. Jones, grossly misunderstood it when you said you lost your homework or that the dog buried it in some ungodly place, the peace offering you made him hardly moved him a single jot, which I am sure left you disillusioned and brokenhearted. Okay, now that's nonsense, of course. But here are the words in that paragraph that I think if you went and looked them up in the Oxford English Dictionary would report their first ever known use in the English language as coming from William Tyndale. It is that much of the paragraph. Isn't that remarkable? That doesn't mean that Tyndale made up all of those words, but I think as best we know, he was the first person to use those in written English. And so those words have come down to us, some of them that you still use today, many of them that you still use today, thanks to Tyndale. So that means that to some degree, each of you use Tyndale's words probably every day. Daniel says, newspaper headlines still quote Tyndale, though unknowingly. So many of our idioms came from him, and he has reached more people than Shakespeare. And we should note that it is not only you who use Tyndale's words, but it was Shakespeare who came two generations later and used Tyndale's English extensively. Some have even suggested that without Tyndale, there would be no Shakespeare. And it was not only Shakespeare, but it was the King James translators who borrowed the words of Tyndale. Now, keep in mind that Tyndale didn't translate the entire Bible. He didn't get the Old Testament finished before he was killed. But of the parts of the Bible he translated, the New Testament and the chunk of the Old Testament, the King James translators, depending on which how you calculate the numbers, use between 80 and 90% of their words are Tyndale's words. So much of the talk about the beauty and the power of the King James Version is actually the beauty and the power of Tyndale. And let me show that to you. I put side by side for you the Lord's Prayer in the 1534, which is the standard edition of Tyndale, and the King James. So just take a minute and look through those phrases. Now, obviously, I updated the spelling and stuff of Tyndale, but I didn't change any of his words, just the spelling. All right, so watch this. What happens if we take Tyndale out of the King James Lord's Prayer? What do we get? That. The reason why the King James was based so heavily upon Tyndale was because, as we'll learn later, the translations between Tyndale and the King James, upon which the King James was based, which the King James was revising, were all Tyndale. They just didn't give him any credit. Tyndale's work was completely knocked off as somebody else's, and even as King Henry VIII's, with no credit. Though I've heard rumor there's a sneaky way that I've got to look up that they snuck in some attribution to him, but I haven't had a chance to look that up yet. We'll get there. There's Tyndale all over Shakespeare. There's Tyndale all over the King James. There's Tyndale all over English today. Here are some other Bible phrases that are from Tyndale nearly 100 years before the KJV. Let there be light. Am I my brother's keeper? Behold the Lamb of God. I am the way, the truth, and the life. In my Father's house are many mansions. With God all things are possible. In him we live, move, and have our being. Be not weary in well-doing. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. Let not your hearts be troubled. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. For my yoke is easy, my burden is light. Asking, it shall be given you. Seeking, you shall find. Knocking, it shall be opened unto you. Beautiful King James English. It just doesn't have anything to do with King James. It's Tyndale. There are... So that's why Lightfoot, I don't have this quote here, but Lightfoot calls him the true father of the English Bible. And I'm not demeaning the King James, that's not my point. I'm just saying there's this misperception that the King James English is so beautiful and majestic, and by and large, it was Tyndale's English that was beautiful and majestic, that they just revised somewhat. There are other common church words that we use that really we use today because Tyndale had the courage to use them when it was very unpopular for him to do so. And that includes words like elder and congregation. The state church, the Catholic Church, you could say, at that time, would greatly have preferred that Tyndale use the word, like priest or bishop instead of elder, and that he used the word church instead of congregation. Because what mattered was the church. There was one church under the authority of the state and Rome. And if you were in the church, you were saved. And if you were not in the church, in good relationship with the church, you weren't. And that was all there was to it. And Tyndale dared to use the word congregation and bring church down to a local level instead of a state level or a papal, popish level. So those words really have come to us thanks to Tyndale. And some other words from Tyndale: thanksgiving, Passover, intercession, brotherly, viper, godless, impure, atonement, all Tyndale. He is the source of the common modern phrase, the signs of the times. And even the very current word network comes from Tyndale. So, Team says the English-speaking world owes Tyndale a debt it is hardly aware of. Daniel says he has been most unfairly neglected. And again, Team says, what is dumbfounding to me is how hidden he remains, how misprized, and how thoroughly uncelebrated. A very deep scholarly analysis that I did in about 20 seconds on Amazon indicates that for every one book about Tyndale, there are at least 50 about Shakespeare. Something like 50 times as much material on Shakespeare. Now, those words I've been quoting to you come from men who are probably Christians. But this is where I want to go now, and I want to begin quoting a little bit from the BBC. Now, admittedly, TV programs are designed with some hyperbole and some flair to get viewers, so let's admit that from the outside. But still, just imagine CNN saying something like this, okay? This man's legacy lives on in every English-speaking country. Tyndale's influence is immeasurable. His genius, now acknowledged, makes him, alongside Shakespeare, one of the co-creators of the modern English language. No one in history has changed our language like he did. And then watch this. He has been written out of history, perhaps because of the savage truths his story reveals about the men and women who dominated Tudor England. Whew. They're daring to suggest that maybe Tyndale's story is so powerful and so verifiably true that it's actually buried intentionally. That there's actually a not above board reason why there are 50 times as many books about Shakespeare as there are about Tyndale. So they mention their savage truths, and it's true that Tyndale lived in a savage time, as I'll explain more of later, and that his story is full of intrigue and ends with his savage death. Now, that is far from the most important reason to learn Tyndale. Tyndale would be well worth learning about if there was no fascinating intrigue and no savage martyrdom at the end of his story. But it is still the facts of what happened, and so here's how Teams says it. Call a manhunt. Throw in a villain, a real slimy one, a Dickens character. Mention the word conspiracy. Set the world against a single unsuspecting Englishman. Betray him into the hands of the local authorities. Cast him into the dank bowels of an old flinty castle. Deny him any kind of light. Have him speak in his own defense at a sham trial. Call him an arch heretic. Condemn him to an eternity in hell. Stand him upright in the midst of dry kindling and gunpowder. Let him utter some memorable last words. Strangle the life out of him. Set him ablaze. And what you have is a great story. And yet that is verifiably what happened to Tyndale. So it is a great story, but it is a true, historically verifiable story about God and the gospel and the Bible in English. So that's my defense of why Tyndale is well worth our time, though ultimately the defense will be what we cover and whether it's helpful or not. Okay, let's jump in, and I want to tell you a little bit about Tyndale's life before he went to Oxford. And that's difficult because we don't have any historical record of Tyndale's life before he went to Oxford. So I'm making up everything I tell you next. No, I'm not making it up. It's just that we know a lot about where Tyndale was from, the area he was from, what it would have been like in the area he was from when he grew up there. We know some about his family, like his brothers. And so there are a lot of things that give us, can make good guesses about Tyndale's early life. So Tyndale was from mid-Gloucestershire. I have no idea how to pronounce those English names. You know, Gloucestershire. We would brutalize it. Gloucestershire, near Wales. Yes, some of you know how to say that better than me. So I will stop trying to say it. There you see it over there. And there is a tall tower that remains in honor of Tyndale. It sits up on a hill, as you can see there, and is visible for miles. So at least in that area, they have not completely forgotten Tyndale. We have several reasons to think that his family was reasonably wealthy and privileged and powerful in the area, though we don't actually know much about his parents, but let me just name a few important considerations about this area of England. And first is the proximity to Wales, where, of course, their first language is Welsh. And a couple things that are interesting about that. First of all, that means that Tyndall grew up in a multilingual setting, very aware of other languages, which may well have played into the fact that he ended up mastering at least eight. But second of all, it's interesting to several writers point out the beauty of Welsh and the emphasis that Welsh puts on not just the function of a language, but its form. For example, I've read that Cardiff, which is the capital of Wales, I think, has four different correct pronunciations in Welsh depending on the sound of the words around it. Not grammatical changes, just changes in how you pronounce it to make it fit with the sound of the other words around it. That is an emphasis on form, on beauty in language that Welsh is to some degree known for and was reflected in Tyndall's translation work and ultimately then in the King James. This flow of how it sounds that is just remarkable, that is an art. So those are possibilities. Again, I can't say any of that for sure, except that we know that he was from the border of Wales, and that would have been very common to him. Secondly, cloth making was a major industry in the region. Probably half the population in his region would have been involved in one way or another in the cloth industry, and we know that his family was very prominent in that industry. So this involved everything from raising the sheep to sea captains who would ship it away and everything in between that really dominated the normal life in that region. So that connects to Tyndall in several different ways. One is one of the first financial backers who helped support his early translation work was a cloth merchant whom he probably had previous connection with. Secondly, it was one of the key ways that Tyndall smuggled his Bibles back into England was through the cloth trade routes, because he had probably a lot of connections there from wealthy family involved with that, and so he used that to smuggle Bibles back in. And thirdly, the followers of John Wycliffe, the Lollards, were commonly associated with the cloth trade. We know that many of the Lollards made their living as they traveled and tried to preach and teach the Bible. They made their living in the cloth trade. So that just makes it very likely that there were frequently followers of Wycliffe in the towns and markets of Tyndall's home area there. Does that make sense? And though it has nothing to do with what we're talking about this morning, I couldn't resist showing you the headline that came with this photo of Gloucestershire sheep on the left side of this picture. This is the real headline. Flock of sheep arrested by police in Gloucestershire. Those poor sheep. I don't know what they did wrong except appear in my PowerPoint. So we were talking about the followers of Wycliffe. They called them the Lollards, and they insulted them by calling them the Lollards. And Wycliffe, remember, had lived a century before Tyndall, but his followers were still very present in Tyndall's day, and the Lollards were known for traveling around England and teaching. And like Wycliffe, they raised concerns about the official Christian church. They emphasized personal faith in the Bible and the importance of the Bible in English. You remember this slide from when we talked about Wycliffe. So we don't know if Tyndall had contact with the Lollards as a boy, but we can say it would be very difficult for him not to have had contact with the Lollards. That would be what would be normal in that kind of family, in that kind of place, in that kind of region at that time. And so it's also notable then that many of the Lollards were burned for their beliefs. At the time of Tyndall's youth, many of the Lollards were being killed for what they were believing and teaching. And it's hard to imagine that he was not aware of that. So if you think of young people today growing up in parts of the world where they are aware of other Christians whom they know being killed for being Christians. Think about how that shapes your faith and the way you think about Christianity and the way you think about courage and the way you think about standing up for certain things. That's probably the setting from which Tyndale came. Any questions? I know I'm flying along. Here's what we've said about the connections of the area that Tyndale was from. We've said he was brought into contact with other languages, including the beauty of Welsh, that he learned this cloth trade that ended up having interesting connections, that he almost surely had connections with the followers of Wycliffe. And then one other thing we can add here is that he did grow up among the common people, even though his family was fairly well-to-do and fairly influential in his region. He still grew up in, a region of England that looked like that, you know, that looked like this. This was his world. In other words, he didn't grow up in the halls of London in a powerful family. He grew up in rural sheep herding country in Gloucestershire at that time probably had a total population of like 50,000 people. So Tyndale grew up with the common people, and that greatly influenced his translation work. You're probably familiar, we'll come to it maybe next week, but his quote about the plowboy knowing the Bible better than this person he was talking to. We'll talk about maybe the setting for that quote, but Tyndale had a heart for the common people. And so you see this combination of a beautiful sounding Bible translation, yet accessible to the common man, was what Tyndale ended up pursuing. All right, finally then for this morning, talk a little bit about Tyndale's religion. And this is just a church somewhere in that part of England. I have no idea if it's like what Tyndale's church would have looked like. But he would have been baptized into the Catholic Church as an infant. He would have been baptized as soon after birth as possible. They would baptize some of those babies the day they were born, because the idea was that if the baby, you know, infant mortality was so high, and the idea was that if the teaching of the Catholic Church at that time was that if the baby wasn't baptized and died, it would go to this place they called limbo. I mean, there was a Latin phrase for it, but it's where our word limbo comes from. That wasn't really purgatory, but wasn't heaven or hell. It was this kind of stuck place where you did not want your baby to go. So you get your baby baptized as soon as you possibly can to make sure that doesn't happen, to make sure he's in the church. And so Tyndale would have been baptized like that. But later in his life, Tyndale clearly came to the conclusion that such a baptism was absurd and unbiblical, and he did not look proudly upon his infant baptism. Remember that we said that the church at this time, the Christian church in Europe under the power of Rome, was really a mess. And this was certainly evident in the region in which Tyndale grew up. Now, some people would accuse us of trying to exaggerate this because it fits our story. But really, the facts that we know about clergy at this time in areas like this in England are just awful. It's just awful. History tells us that the priests in his area of England were, quote, almost non-resident about this same time. In other words, you kind of didn't even know they existed. And there were three bishops in charge of the church in that region of England, all three of whom were Italians who never set foot in England. And at this time in the history of the church in England, the local priests would have usually been uneducated, not even known Latin, and would have been much better known for their sexual promiscuity than their theological or spiritual maturity. Now, again, somebody could say, well, that's just because that's the report. Nobody reported the good priests. They only talked about the bad priests. I suppose that's possible. But still, the historical records indicate that there was a level of sexual deviance that was just terrible among a biblically illiterate priesthood. And so That suggests, though again we don't know for sure, but it suggests that Tyndale grew up knowing how broken the official Christian church really was. All right, so that brings us then to Tyndale's education. And next time I'll begin with Tyndale at Oxford, which I think he spent something like 9 years at Oxford. And we'll talk about how Tyndale could spend so long at Oxford and never end up an Oxford man at all. That's a very key part of his story. But before that, all we know is that that we have good records of good education in that area of England at that time. So it's likely that Tyndale, especially from a prominent family, went to kindergarten even, went to good schools and learned well and went to Oxford when he was like 14, which wasn't unusual in that day. So that's the guesses we can make about those first years of Tyndale's life. And then we really don't know a lot about his early years at Oxford earlier, basically nothing, but we can make some guesses about that because we can know what Oxford was like at that time. So we'll start into that next time. So any questions about that so far? This is all the dull part of the story before people start trying to kill each other and smuggle things. And we'll get to that. Yeah, we'll get to that. The different winds that blew against him. But Tyndale was much more than just a translator of the Bible in English. He was a precursor of the Reformation. So it wasn't just his English translation work, though that was true, but it was his theology too. So yeah, it was a combination of those things. More so than with Wycliffe, though Wycliffe certainly got himself in trouble for his theology and was called a heretic. But Tyndale, as we saw in that quote earlier, was very publicly called the arch heretic. Like the greatest heretic there can be, is what we're saying, right? The number one heretic in our day. And part of the reason why we say Tyndale lived in a savage time was because the simple facts are that the Catholic Church in the early 1400s had declared that what we do with heretics is we publicly kill them so that nobody else will make the same mistakes they made. That was the official declaration of the church that was still being carried out in Tyndale's time. So this was an age when you voiced disagreement with what the church believed, and what was most likely was you would be publicly killed. And it happened all the time to many, many people. It was that's why the quote earlier about how his story seems to get buried because of the savage truths it reveals about who was in charge of Tudor England at that time. The King James translators operated in a very, very different setting. England was a very different place 100 years later, where that kind of public burning and stuff was almost completely gone. But in Tyndale's day, it was just the norm. Any other questions? In all of this, remember that we're pre-Reformation. We're in the early winds of the Reformation. So there's not yet a divide between Protestant and Catholic. It's just still the one Christian church, for better or worse, that has been for the past 1,000 years, right? So we're still not yet to the point where there was a clear break from Roman Catholic doctrine and establishment of other churches. It's all just one thing. If you were English, you were Christian, and you were in the state church because you were baptized when you were a newborn. And that was all there was to it. Are you a Christian? Of course I'm a Christian. I'm English, right? Or I'm Spanish, or I'm, and they were all Christian. Everybody was Christian. And part of what Wycliffe emphasized, part of what the Lollards emphasized, part of what Tyndale emphasized is you individually have to ask the question, are you a Christian? Have you been saved? And that was not what the church wanted to hear, because the church was glad to have everybody in its fold. You know, you were baptized into our church, we've got you, you know. So that whole idea of personal faith connects then to you can read the Bible for yourself. If we can teach you to read and you can get the Bible in your own language, And then you can decide what God says. And that idea was just so foreign to them. Tim?
So, just to clarify, that there was no break at this time, in those times, between the church in England and Rome. It was...
Off and on, depending on what the king needed, you know, depending on who was king and what the mood was of the day. But even when there was a break, at Tyndale's time, even if the relationship between London and Rome was poor, the king never would have said, "I'm not in the Catholic Church." He would have said, "The Pope's not going to tell us what to do in our government," or something. But it's not until, you know, three generations later that you would have a king of England say, or a queen of England say, "We are Protestants." That's much after Tyndale. Yeah. All right. We'll get into the fun stuff next week. Thank you for your good attention, and hope this is helpful.